In his latest book, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, Jeff Charlotte investigates the family, a religio-political organization that calls itself invisible, comprised of not-so-invisible political figures whose headquarters are a townhouse in Washington, D.C. Mr. Charlotte uncovers startling facts about the family's involvement in issues ranging from Watergate to Ugandan genocide. The book is published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased that it brings Jeff Charlotte back to our show. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. Good to be here.
Is this an update on your New York Times bestseller about this group called The Family?
It's a little bit. That book was in many ways the history of the organization based on their own archives. And after the success of that book, a number of people involved in the organization started coming to me with new documents, and I realized that I was able to tell both the story about the present of this organization, but also to look at it very much in the context of what's going on in religion and politics in the United States today.
Now, why did they bring you those documents? This has been a secretive organization.
Oh, well, these are whistleblowers. For instance, one young man who'd grown up in the organization was dismayed upon learning of their connections to a really virulent anti-gay initiative in Uganda, the anti-homosexuality bill, death penalty for gay people.
Which and has been in the news, but not with too many connections made to the family.
Exactly. And, well, a little bit. I mean, the man who wrote the bill is the leader of their one of the leaders of the organization over there. And this young man was dismayed by that. And so he said, look, you know, I've been a part of this my whole life. He had been an activist, and he says, but this is too far. So he started sharing with me, for instance, documents related to Senator Jim Inhofe, a Republican from Oklahoma, who has been traveling to Africa, has in fact visited Africa, I think, more than any other senator, adopting countries, as he puts it, for the family and teaching them how to run their governments according to Jesus's principles, or as he defines them, which essentially amount to the exporting of American culture war overseas.
And it's made a member of the parliament in Uganda, David Bahati, one of the prominent politicians in his country.
Sad to say, he's the most famous Ugandan since Idi Amin, because this bill that's so draconian, death penalty for gay people, 7 years in prison for promotion, just this conversation we're having right now, 3 years in prison if you're a heterosexual person and you know a gay person and you fail to report them in 24 hours. Most draconian bill in the world. And he really sees it as just a start. And working with his sort of sister organizations, part of this worldwide family, as he puts it, in the parliaments of other countries like Rwanda, Burundi, he says this can be the beginning of doing in Africa what America has failed to do and what so many of his American mentors, men like Senator Inhofe, are saying, we've lost the culture war with the gays here in America, but you can win it still in Africa.
Now, Rick Warren, the famous pastor from California who actually gave the invocation or convocation at President Obama's inauguration, he was involved in this too, but he has distanced himself.
He did.
But was he a member of the family?
No, he's not. And, you know, one of the things that I argue with the family is that this is not the grand monolithic, conspiracy or something like that. There's no conspiracy here. This is just one of the many sort of streams of conservative activism in Washington, and important because it has been overlooked and because it's influential. But Rick Warren certainly represents another very powerful stream. And when you see those ideas, I mean, the reason I ended up going to Uganda and spending a lot of time there and saying this is a case study in some ways for how we can understand what the impact of American fundamentalism is. Because so many American fundamentalists saw in this desperately impoverished country a place where they could have huge influence, where they could fight the same culture war battles we're fighting here and win. So Rick Warren is going over there, and as David Bahati said, Rick Warren came and visited his Parliament Fellowship, which is modeled on the family's group here in Washington, and talked to them about moral issues, homosexuality, and so on. What Bahati came up with, killing all the gay people, well, that's – Rick Warren says, well, that's not what I meant. But there's a still kind of a lack of responsibility, a lack of concern about the impact of their ideas.
Now, this organization hasn't gotten a lot of media attention even though it has so many influential people. Is the press purposely backing off?
No, I don't think so. I think the organization – the story I tell in the beginning of the book, and part of why I returned to this, is I had come out with a book about the history of the organization in 2008. It, you know, it does okay, but what it really takes off in 2009 with the sex scandals of Senator John Ensign, Governor Mark Sanford, who redefines the Appalachian Trail, is going all the way down to Argentina, and former Congressman Chip Pickering, who are all connected to the group's sort of Capitol Hill headquarters, this house on C Street they used to provide subsidized housing for congressmen they're associated with, and which was also sort of central to the cover-up of those affairs. And when that blew up, you saw lots of press attention to the organization because it fit into the model that our political press has for dealing with religion. It's a sex scandal. Sex scandals, we can understand, you know,
hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy. It's an old story. And it, unfortunately, what happened is it sort of began there and ended there. So much so that really the bigger story to come out of that particular case, the ongoing Justice Department investigation, the cover-up of Senator Ensign's affair, not because he slept with someone other than his wife, but because there was violations of lobbying laws, those kinds of things. That didn't become part of the story. And as you look out into the world, when you start following the money out from C Street, you see things that are even more disturbing, like former Congressman Mark Siljander pled guilty this past July to using the organization to essentially launder money that he was accepting from a terrorist organization.
Well, how do they justify these things? They have to deal with the press, or does the press not come to them? Does it deal with Ensign or Pickering or Sanford totally on their own?
Well, they don't have to deal with it. I mean, now they have to deal with the press a little bit. You know, after the Uganda issue, they started working with this is a Rick Warren connection, a guy named A. Larry Ross, who's a sort of a super flack for the evangelical world, a PR man. And their response, according to an email correspondence that was leaked to me from within the organization, was their response to the deal within Uganda, which they were upset about. They knew this was going to make them look terrible. And some of them were genuinely opposed, was we've got to manage PR. And so they've taken these sort of very, very tentative steps toward transparency, but they're dealing with a theology defined by their longtime leader who says the more invisible you can make your organization, the more influence it will have. That's a direct quote. And they see that not as a conspiratorial idea, but as a religious idea. They almost see it as humility.
Well, but how do they deal with the fact that any number of their prominent members have committed adultery?
The way that they look at that.
It's just human failing?
It's human failing. And those men are there in power, not, as they put it, you know, we elect our leaders, but Jesus elects his. Those men are anointed for power. So they take a bit of scripture, Acts 9:15. This man is my chosen instrument to take my name before the Gentiles and their kings. And in their documents, they underline their kings. They believe that scripture calls upon them to be missionaries to the powerful, and that they have this idea they can help the weak, but the way you help the weak is by helping the strong. It's a very profoundly anti-populist idea and literally anti-democratic idea going back to the early days when they opposed democracy. But and yet when it starts converging, as it is now and today in this elections, you know, through a figure like Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who's a longtime resident of the C Street House, who's able to harness that populist power of the Tea Party and align it with his kind of elitist understanding of religion and authority, then you have a transformative moment.
Well, if the election turns out the way it looks like it might, where a number of candidates have run as Christians rather than just simply as people who are members of the Democratic or Republican Party, maybe there'll be more people moving over to C Street. Mm-hmm. But you say that they believe that men elected by citizens are, in fact, selected by God?
The guy who expressed this most clearly to me was David Bahati, the member of parliament in Uganda, who got his political education here in the United States, came to Washington, studied with a conservative organization called the Leadership Institute, and they put him in touch with the family. He started meeting these American politicians. He met Senator Ensign. He met Senator Mitch McConnell. He was very impressed by these guys and went back to Uganda to say, I want to try and sort of do politics in the American way. And he said, what happens is, he says, no, we have voters. He says, but God uses voters. God uses voters to select who's going to be in power. And I mean, you see that very much in the rhetoric of Senator Jim DeMint, who, in talking about someone like Sharon Engel in Nevada, he wants her elected by the people. But once she's there, in his mind, she's going to be like him, someone who has been God has sort of maneuvered the pieces on the playing board to arrange this alignment of power.
Now, I use a number of different names for this group, the family. Also, what are some of the other names? Are they how did this whole thing start? How was it founded?
Well, it began in 1935 when the founder of the group was sort of looking at the Great Depression. He saw the Great Depression as a punishment from God for the New Deal, for our attempts to regulate the market. And he believed that God came to him one night and said, Christianity has been getting it wrong for 2,000 years by focusing on the poor, the weak, the suffering, the down and out. If you can instead focus on those whom he would come to call the up and out, the top men, the key men, and work through them, work through those who I have given power or wealth. If they're power and wealthy, it's because I put them there, then they can dispense the blessings to the rest of us through a kind of trickle-down religion. And over the years, so that became International Christian Leadership. 1969, the current leader took over, and he said, look, we don't want a public profile. It just gets in the way of our work, so let's submerge it. There's a number of nonprofit entities which are interlinked, connected to it. The biggest is the Fellowship Foundation, sometimes called the Fellowship. But he himself, the longtime leader, prefers to call it the family and prefers that model of an international family of brothers who are linked in this cause.
Well, that I was searching for the word the fellowship. So we have the family, the fellowship, and we have also C Street House. Now, C Street House, is that in a way referring to K Street, or is this just that this townhouse is on C Street?
It's 133 C Street Southeast. And the reason I mentioned the address, it's a public address, is because it's registered as a church. It's tax exempt as a church.
It's a residence, you say.
It's a residence. A number of the politicians, when the scandal started coming out, said, I didn't know it was a church. I didn't know anything religious was going on there. That wasn't a particularly persuasive excuse, but they are getting subsidized rent. There's a great group called Clergy Voice, an interdenominational group of pastors who are challenging that status with the IRS because they say, look, this is giving church a bad name. Churches, if you want that tax exemption, if you want to be a church in American life, which is perfectly appropriate, you have to be open to the public and so on. And this is a group that is defined by not being open to the public. As the leader of the group says, what we do is we create a space for politicians to get together, to listen to Jesus as they understand him, and to make decisions beyond the din of the vox populi. That was their phrase, beyond the voice of the people.
Now, how many people are actually living there? Because it was my understanding that you get elected to Congress and you find a house or an apartment in Washington, move your family in, or
don't move your family in. In fact, one of the really most interesting critics of the organization came not from the left but from the right, from a fundamentalist magazine called World Magazine, which they're very hard right, Christian right magazine. But their concerns with the group were the same as anyone else's. This is politics and secrecy don't go well together. They said, you know, this idea that Jesus came to minister to the few and not to the many, as the group believes. They said this is not Christianity as we would find it in any church. So they started investigating, and they had they spoke to Ann Ryan, who was the wife of former Congressman Jim Ryan, very, very conservative Christian politician from Kansas. She described them attempting to sort of get her husband to move in, and he didn't want to do it. He wanted to live with his family. And she said, you know, over the years I've observed them, they try and break politicians away from their family because they want them to create this sort of bond of loyalty to each other and to the organization. And one wife of a leader within the organization says it's always been this way. First comes the family, not her family, the organization. Second come our children. Third comes me. But the brothers are always first.
Are they always Republicans?
No, they're really not. And that's one of the ways the group has survived for so long, is by not hitching its star too tightly to any one political faction. It's always about 80% Republican. The C Street House, Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma describes, he said, we need to get some Democrats involved in this. A number of politicians came in the last big Republican wave of 94. That's when the House took off. So he went and recruited Congressman Bart Stupak, who's now leaving. a Democrat from Michigan, conservative Democrat, most famous for his Stupak Pitts Amendment, anti-abortion amendment that nearly derailed health care. Heath Shuler, another very conservative Democrat from North Carolina, lives there now. Mike McIntyre, a Democrat to the right of most of the Republican Party, is a guy who's been going there. I think most of all, Senator Mark Pryor, Democrat of Arkansas, who has since distanced himself from the organization. But a few years ago when I spoke to him about this, he said, well, now he's a Democrat. He's a pro-war, anti-labor, anti-choice, anti-gay, pro-prayer in schools, anti-evolution Democrat. He is a Democrat. And he said that through the family, he had learned the meaning of bipartisanship and what it was that Jesus didn't come to take sides. He came to take over. That was the exact quote that he gave. And I think that's their idea. And they don't experience that, though.
So they don't believe in separation of church and state.
Senator Inhofe, who's been perhaps the most outspoken member of the group and one of the most candid, calls separation of church and state the phoniest idea there ever was. You know, there was a lot of uproar when Christine O'Donnell, the Tea Party Senate candidate in Delaware, said she didn't believe in separation of church and state, and people sort of laughed, ignoring the fact that there's a number of congressmen who already think that.
My guest is Jeff Charlotte, Sharlett. His latest book, Sea Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. It is published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jeff Charlotte. His latest book, Sea Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. It's published by Little Brown. Are you the only journalist who have gotten inside the Sea Street house?
Not anymore. Part of the part of what they described in their internal correspondence as managing PR was working with a reporter for The New Yorker named Peter Boyer. And they decided to give him access. And he did a story that is kind of more of a Q&A with the longtime leader, Doug Coe. He wasn't really dealing with the archival documents. He wasn't dealing with the history. And, you know, I would argue that when you try and approach an organization that's been around for 70 years without the context of history and without a real engagement with theology, I mean, I think that's a big part of why political reporters tend to miss it, is this is a religious movement within politics. And until you engage with that, you're not really doing it. So he got inside C Street and came out with some, you know, interesting sound bites from the leader, but, not as effective. But there have been other reporters who've done great reporting. Lisa Getter for the LA Times did a terrific investigation. You know, over the years, there's been a number of folks. It takes time, though, to really get at the core of the story.
But how did you gain access? Weren't they suspicious of you? You've written for publications mostly considered liberal, the Rolling Stone, Harper's, Mother Jones, The Nation, New Republic.
Well,
I don't see the National Review here.
No, you know, I keep sending them pitches. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
And you're half Jewish. Would that have bothered them?
No. In fact, one of their ideas, and again, why they, you know, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance. They don't experience themselves as judgmental. As one leader of the organization says, the only reason we use Jesus is because Jesus is central to every religion. And I was surprised by that. So I asked him to explain it to me. And he says, well, Jesus is central to Christianity. That's true. He says, and Jesus is central to Islam. That was surprising. But what he was referring to is the fact that Jesus is a part of Islam. He's mentioned 110 times in the Quran, as they're fond of pointing out. And they claim that the Quran points toward Jesus. But then the kicker for me was when he said Jesus is central to Judaism. And I said, really? How does that work? And he said, well, Jesus comes at the end. And I tried to explain that, no, Judaism sort of cuts off before that. And he says, but Jews revere Jesus, right? And I said, there's just not a relationship. And there's that kind of – I mean, that's a form of kind of theological narcissism, to imagine that your faith, what moves you is and feels universal to you, must – be experienced in the same way by everyone. And that's what guides many of these politicians. They don't feel like they're being religious bullies, as they are. They feel like, well, we all know this is true.
Is that what led you to write that Sea Street was more unsettling than anything you'd witness in writing about other religions?
Well, I've been writing about religion and American life for a long time. And when I first stumbled upon this movement, in fact, I had been spending a year sort of exploring the varieties of religious experience in American life for another book. And I'd seen all kinds of things. I mean, I'd seen things that people might categorize as extremes. I'd seen Pentecostal exorcisms. I had seen, you know, military pagans in the military. I had seen very right-wing megachurches. But I had never encountered anything, one, so really at the heart of American power. These weren't fringe characters. I mean, when you're talking about Senator John Thune, Senator Ensign, Senator Coburn, Senator Inhofe, Senator Brownback, soon to be Senator Moran, you know, these weren't fringe characters. Sort of, they weren't even like Jerry Falwell pounding on the door from the outside trying to get in. They were on the inside, and yet they were approaching Christianity in a way that I think would astonish even the most conservative Christians. They'd say, this isn't what Jesus meant.
On the other hand, you say that they have succeeded by working the margins. They may not be fringe characters, but they understand that they don't need to build a mass movement? Or is the Tea Party grow out of some of this thinking?
No, the Tea Party is really, I think, represents one, as I say, one of these transformative moments when you have the convergence of a kind of a populist angry right with the elite right. And Senator Jim DeMint, that's why I keep coming back to him, because he's the standard bearer of this. And I think there's a lot of debate, is the Tea Party religious or not? And what they don't recognize is that guys like DeMint and Coburn, who are the gatekeepers for these Tea Party folks who want to come to Washington, they're putting a religious stamp on that. They view these economic ideas as religious. But when I say they work the margins, what I mean is that a lot of times they will focus on politicians who aren't as glamorous. For instance, Representative Joe Pitts in Pennsylvania, longtime Republican, as a workhorse, as a guy who gets the job done. You know, can have these sort of incremental transformative steps on policy. That's within American life. And then the margins overseas, they go to countries where in the book, this book, I talk about Uganda and Lebanon in particular. For instance, Coburn is going over to Lebanon as the face of U.S. foreign policy on taxpayer dime, saying, I've got the solution to the Middle East crisis. It's Jesus. He's going to the Muslim leadership of Lebanon and saying, you need to convert to Jesus. This is hijacking foreign policy, but it's taking place far enough away from the mainstream of American life that no one's paying attention.
Well, when Ann Coulter said that we should invade all of those Muslim countries and Christianize the people, there was a huge outcry. But there doesn't seem to be an outcry when a member of Congress says, in effect, the same sort of thing.
Exactly. Well, I mean, and Senator Inhofe, who, again, I have it's my favorite. If there was trading cards for the family, that would be my favorite card of Senator Inhofe, because he's so candid about what he's doing. He's saying, I'm going overseas and I'm promoting the political philosophy of Jesus as taught to me by the family. I'm using my status as a U.S. senator to open the doors to the leaders of the world and saying, I want you to follow Jesus. And I'm doing it all on your dime, by the way. He's very proud of the fact that he uses military transportation charges of taxpayers to do this.
You've also noted the presence of a small but powerful movement of spiritual warriors within the officer corps of the U.S. military. Who are these spiritual warriors?
This is a movement. I mean, this is, again, one of those convergence movements where you take moments where you take a populist movement. And within the military, there's a kind of populist fundamentalism that has links and overlaps with the family and organizational overlaps, but it's really its own thing and it's a different thing. But it's grown to such a place that now you have something, a group like Officers Christian Fellowship, 15,000 officers. Again, that's not fringe. These are officers, General Bob Caslin, General Robert Van Antwerp, senior officers who are explicit in their idea that the military is a Christian institution and its responsibility is to wage real war, physical war, but also spiritual war, and that those who are opposed to that within the armed forces, military people who don't share their faith, including those who are Christians. Methodist doesn't count. You know, Episcopalian doesn't count. They describe these people as spiritual terrorists. This is a real departure from the First Amendment, and it's part of what I speak of when I say the threat to democracy. I mean, these are people who have pretty much left democracy behind.
We don't have much time, but you also spent some time in Ivanwald, Virginia. The same sort of thing as C Street?
C Street is the sort of House or Congressman Ivanwald, is the place where my encounter with this group began, is sort of the C Street for young leaders, the leaders that they're grooming for the future,
and
the future residents
you.
Of C Street. I spent a little less than a month there, and I think I'm a terrible disappointment to them. But it was my first encounter, and what sent me to the archives and sent me talking to the political members sent me eventually to Uganda to see the sort of the darkest manifestation of these ideas.
Jeff Charlotte will be in conversation with Damon Linker, hosted by Mark Crispin Miller, tonight at 7 at McNally Jackson Books. That's at 52 Prince Street. For more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. And the book is called C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. And you obviously do see this as a threat, not just as some aberration or some wrinkle.
It's a threat, the idea, not theocracy, but the deep paternalism of the organization, the idea that these men know best.
The publisher is Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us again. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Leonard.